Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week, and we tape it on Friday morning. We're going to begin by reading a poem, another poem by Lynn Ekdahl, our political poet, entitled The Dominant Cast. The Donald appeals to the dominant cast, to those whose deep wish is to not come in last, to those whose main drive is to keep down the other, who think they will thrive if some people they smother. The Donald enhances the grievances they feel, convinces, confirms that such feelings are real. He's offered up scapegoats the others to blame, suggests that these folks are deserving of shame. The primary others are those who aren't white, whose otherness thus can be seen at first sight. Others are also those who aren't Christian or straight. Women are other and easy to hate. The Donald encourages hatred and rage, urges that others be pushed out or caged. Keep out migrants and Muslims and halt DEI. Harass all the trans folks just living their lives. And as for the women who think they can choose, they have laws that are pending. There's so much more to lose. And if you aren't wondering what more can they do, remember Niemöller. Next thing, they're coming for you. Ooh, she is getting better and better. That's because she's got so much content here to work with. Joining us right now is our fabulous panel of talkers. We have Stephen Pimper, senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. He's also the author of four books, including A People's History of Poverty in America. But his most recent book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change, received the 2023 Best Book Award from the Society for Social Work and Research. Let me welcome Mr. Pimper back to the program. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of eight books, and his writings have appeared in Reuters, New York Times, NBC, the San Francisco Examiner. And if you want more of Lincoln's work, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you for doing this, Lincoln, and also thank you for stepping in for me on Thursday. So again, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Arnie. Great to be here.
Adam Finkel, clinical professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan of Public Health. Finkel's research, writing, advocacy, and litigation focuses on a variety of occupational health programs, including CTE and football, environmental contamination. Now, this is the most operative line because I'm going to be tossing right to you, Adam Finkel. You put in your bio, you are the dad of a 23-year-old daughter conceived by in vitro fertilization, which makes him concerned about SCOTUS and the prospect of it going after IVF. I want to welcome Adam to the program. Not only did you sense exactly what was going to happen as a result of Dobbs, but Alabama sadly has basically made what your fear become a reality. So let me welcome you back to the program, Adam. Thank you so much for doing
this. Thank you. Highlight of the week.
All right. We got to start with the IVF. You put this in your bio. I want people to understand that you put in the bio that you're the dad of a 23-year-old daughter. Millions of people have IVF children. Millions of people, including, by the way, Nikki Haley, which I think is also so interesting here. But what Alabama did, it was predictable because you predicted it. You, however, sort of looked at the Supreme Court for perhaps expanding their interpretation, but all you needed was a Supreme Court in Alabama to have an interesting concept of what personhood is, and of course, then cling to the Bible. And between the Bible and their understanding of personhood, it is not surprising that they had an assault on IVF, and now all the IVF programs in Alabama are shutting down, and people are racing to remove their frozen embryos out of Alabama. But then the question becomes, you know, what place is safe? You're seeing people going to Texas and removing their fertilized eggs. You're seeing them everywhere. And what does this tell you? How chilling is this situation? But as a father of an IVF daughter, like, how are you reacting? And how do we explain to the American people that these kinds of scenarios are not isolated to a Supreme Court? They actually have a connection from policy to the people you elect.
Exactly. So I started putting that in my bio when Amy Coney Barrett was up for confirmation, because I had read some of her, I would say, fringe Catholic views, and I consider her a terrorist because, you know, the achievement of my life was struggling with our couple's infertility and 5 years of IVF and succeeding beyond our wildest expectations. And so it's the conflagration of the fringe anti-religious movement that thinks that somehow IVF dehumanizes sex and conception and human relationships, which of course it doesn't. But the question of the excess embryos, of the frozen embryos. So here we have judges who, like most judges, can't possibly read a scientific abstract or a paper, but can't read either their testament or the older one, neither of which say this. I mean, Jeremiah was being called by God personally to be a prophet. It doesn't mean when I knit you in your mother's womb. And of course, that's implantation, which is after the creation of the blastocyst in vitro. So yeah, Amy Coney Barrett thinks that my wife and I sinned by having the gametes meet in a petri dish, which we had to do. Now IVF is going to be criminalized in Alabama because of this wrongful death thing. And the scientific thing I want to say from personal experience is in the five-year struggle, far more blastocysts were implanted and destroyed by nature, both the old natural way, the Nikki Haley way, which is not IVF. She used artificial insemination, which is a technology, but is not in vitro, as I understand it. And then through many, many cycles of IVF, where we did not have excess embryos, we were struggling to produce enough eggs, and we always put them all in. And, you know, cycle after cycle, they did not. So, you know, if that's a crime, then nature committed dozens of crimes against us before we succeeded. So the whole thing is just repugnant, and it's terrorism.
So I'm going to toss to you, Stephen Pimper, and that is Mark Joseph Stern wrote a fabulous piece. Alabama's assault on IVF is even worse than it sounds. Despite that, there was a tweet by a woman who also writes about this, and she references the Slate article by Mark, but then she goes on to say, I'm going to go a step further and say that the ruling in the IVF case in Alabama is even worse than Mark Joseph Stern has laid out in his fabulous article. This is catastrophic ruling, if left to stand, for so many reasons. First and foremost, this ruling is unabashed in its use of a particular brand of Christianity as the reasoning behind it. It establishes that a particular reading of the Bible is the basis for law. You know, the Bible that also endorses slavery and death by stoning. So theocracy is bad enough. Then there's the fact that this will put an end to IVF in the state. Ironically, the sorts of people getting IVF, richer, whiter, are probably more likely to vote for Trump than the general population. But it gets worse. Then there's the impact on abortion. This means no abortion ever, no exceptions until after fetal death, not even for ectopic pregnancies, and probably molar ones, not like those judges understood that there isn't even a fetus. But it gets worse. There's also probably bans like many kinds of birth control. As soon as a sperm meets an egg, that's a person. Anything that prevents pregnancy after that is murder, so Plan B is gone. But it gets worse. This sets up Alabama to start using the felony murder rule to go after doctors, pharmacists, and people in other states who help women get abortions, which they will absolutely do not make, which makes everyone in the state of Alabama that this makes now a 50-state ban, excuse me. But it gets worse. I mean, she goes on and on and on. It also means that natural law is enshrined as legal justification for decisions. So no sex without the purposes of procreation, no more tubal ligation or HRT if the GOP decides that it's against God's law. It's the end of LGBT people in the U.S. effectively, but it gets worse. And she goes on and on and on. And Stephen, I mean, I read her tweet and I'm like, oh my God. And we keep thinking, how fantastical is this? It's not. It's not. It is so damn real. And I keep thinking about, you know, what happened with Afghanistan, with the Taliban and everything else. And then I'm looking at these justices in Alabama and I'm thinking, what's the difference? Where's my burqa? They're going to be covering me from head to toe because nobody should see me, and they will control every aspect of my life.
So as you and Adam have both observed, we could see this coming, right? And all we had to do was read the concurrence in the Dobbs decision written by Clarence Thomas, which explicitly said that one of the implications of the Dobbs decision is that the entire architecture in Supreme Court precedents that identifies a right to privacy that governs things like access to birth control, right? That is part of the decision that the Obergefell decision that legalized same-sex marriage, that he didn't mention this, but that also undergirds interracial marriage, right? Conveniently omitted, right? We could see all of this coming, and we saw all of it in some ways coming to a head this week. The Heritage Foundation and Chris Rufo, right, who's behind a lot of the anti-education efforts in Florida, both explicitly said that it is long past time when women should be able to have sex without consequences, and therefore it is time to render illegal birth control. We saw the Tennessee governor, it is so hard to keep track, the Tennessee governor signed a bill that allows public officials in that state to refuse to officiate same-sex marriages. Right. Nassau County in New York, a county official formally forbade trans girls from participating in girls and women's sports. And we should also note that a non-binary student in Oklahoma was died. It's there's all sorts of efforts to obfuscate what actually went on, but was involved in a fight in the bathroom and died the following day, right? This is all it seems to me of a piece. And two things to wrap up. One is that this is all, it's evil and it's cruel and it's dangerous, but it's also deeply unpopular with most of the public, right? It's now that the Republican Party is just like a whole bunch of weird genital-obsessed freaks all the way down, right? The other thing to say about this is the cruel and dangerous part. This is about control of women, right? Oh. This is what roots all of this. This is how the both forcing you to have children and not allowing you to have children are the same thing. Because it is about control, not about reproduction itself.
So this is a statistic from the week before, and it didn't fit into this week. I so apologize, Stephen Pepere. But Lincoln Mitchell, I want to remind everyone that rape led to 64,000 pregnancies in 14 U.S. states with abortion bans. Translation, 14 states were accomplices to rapists. Okay, that's exactly what it was. And I want to remind everyone, and then I'll toss you, Lincoln, that in response to the lack of a perhaps an exception to the abortion ban in Texas, you had Governor Abbott saying, well, our answer is we're going to get rid of the rapists. Well, how is he doing? It is so shocking. But if any woman, I don't care, conservative, Republican, now with the IVF decision, now with the rape thing, now with ectopical pregnancies, think about all the things they're doing. Anything that touches a woman's body now is something they want to control. And that means all women are vulnerable in all the states, Lincoln. And you're not safe in New York. You're not safe in Minnesota or Vermont, because the consequences are now going to be impacting, as they said, all 50 states. And this is absolutely horrific. Now the question is, how do we connect that to what happens in November?
I want to start with this Oklahoma, because we have to say their names. Nex Benedict. That's the person who was killed. That's non-Benedict. And say their names. I know he didn't, it's an oversight, but we should say that here. I'm listening to the show this far, and of course, I'm reading this news during the week, and I'm coming to this conclusion that, you know, who knew that Margaret Atwood was an optimist? I mean, this makes The Handmaid's Tale look like a sitcom where we are. And I want to make a connection between IVF and the anti-vax movement. And I'm going to tell a story, a true story. Shortly before my first son was born, my wife and I went to the doctor, the pediatrician, to meet the guy and talk about, I don't know, fill out forms, that kind of stuff. And the doctor said, you know what, it was my first child. And the doctor said, at our office, we insist that all the children get vaccinated. And I said, well, because not being a smartass, but I didn't quite know what he was saying. I said, well, isn't that your job? Meaning I'm not going to take a needle and vaccinate my kid. I mean, I hope you're going to. And he said, yeah. And then my wife, kind of as we were leaving, I'd never heard of this anti-vax movement. And the reason is because I had always thought that vaccinations were kind of a miracle of science, that people don't get sick and die of things that are, you know, polio and stuff. I thought that was great. And similarly, IVF, you know, I'm not a doctor. I took a biology class in college, but I'm not a doctor. And I don't really understand the real science behind IVF, but I kind of think it's a miracle of science. And I was never like the idea that this would be anything but a positive. And I don't think, whereas I know my views are out of the mainstream on a lot of things, I think on those two issues, those are pretty mainstream views. And the radical attack on this is just that. And it's everything that Stephen and Adam have said. It is a real effort to remake the United States as a theocracy. And I want to just touch on what you said about, well, let me just, one thing first. The question, to build on something Stephen said, who wants to live in this country? In a country where those are the rules, where a country where if you are a woman, the state is overtly trying to control you. They're not even playing games with that anymore. How you can have sex, you know, what happens when you have sex, how frequently, everything. Who wants to live in that country, even if you're not a woman? Who wants that? And you touched on something, Arnie. You said this is not, you know, you're not safe in New York. You're not safe in, if you didn't say California, but I'm going to say California, Vermont, wherever. And that cannot be stressed enough.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that the lie that underpins the Dobbs decision, the, oh, don't worry about it, it's going to be okay lie, is that it just gives it back to the states. This is just federalism. This is what the founders wanted. And then the Republican nominee for president, who is, by the way, is the former president who made the Supreme Court possible, has pledged to continue putting justices like this on the court and to sign a national abortion ban. And if he's going to sign a national abortion ban, he'll sign a ban on IVF. Who knows what he'll, if it comes to him, he'll probably sign a ban on birth control. This is not a state issue. So when you say what this comes down to in November, it's, you know, I was struck by something that Hillary Clinton said in a class that I was working, where she was teaching, I was working on the class. And she basically said, every election is an election, is a choice between the lesser of two evils. And that's certainly true now. And I understand why a lot of people aren't excited by Joe Biden. I'm not excited by Joe Biden. I'm not asking or hoping that Joe Biden excites me. I'm asking that he not turn America into a white nationalist theocracy. And if you want America to be a white nationalist theocracy, you can vote for Trump. Heck, you can vote for Bobby Kennedy Jr., which is also a vote for Trump, or Cornel West, or you can stay home and feel self-righteous. But unfortunately, if you don't want America to turn into a white nationalist theocracy, you have exactly one option, and that's to vote for Joe Biden. And it's maybe not the option all of us want, but that's what it is right now.
I'm going to take it to another level, but to some extent, Adam, since you deal with issues of public health, the headline, Florida Surgeon General defies science amid measles outbreak. There are a number, I think there are 12 states now where they've discovered measles, okay? Minnesota, Florida, whatever. The Surgeon General basically is now saying something that every doctor and public health person is absolutely out of their mind. The Surgeon General failed to urge parents to vaccinate their children or keep unvaccinated students home from school as a precaution in a letter to parents in the Fort Lauderdale area. Now, it turns out that the incubation period, you cannot be showing measles 4 days before. You can communicate this disease 4 days before you even show the measles. And then afterwards, it's another 4 days. And then the measles can actually stay on in the air and on surfaces. Okay. This is something we basically conquered with the vaccinations. And he is telling people in a lot of ways, because he's an anti-vaxxer, not to even bother with this. And so I was on a radio show, Adam, this morning. And someone said, well, you know why we have measles? I said, why? Because of all those undocumented immigrants that are coming across the border that are bringing measles with them. I said, well, here's the good news. Now all they have to do is come from Florida. Okay. Now they're coming from Tallahassee. Now I said, so don't tell me this, because remember, measles is not going to stay in Florida. And think about all the people that go to Florida. They go to Florida because of Orlando. They go to Florida because of the beaches. And now people are buying into this anti-vax crap. And now what happens is their kid gets measles, but then they come home on the airplane. Everyone on the airplane is susceptible to it. Think about this. This is anti-science. This is anti-public health. And now they're turning around and saying, blame the immigrants. And I'm looking at the Surgeon General. I'm saying, but if you're vaccinated, guess what? You have no worries and no one to blame because you've protected your child. But look at the choices we're being told to make. It's absolutely horrific. It's now not just about abortion and IVF. It's now not just about birth control. It is this anti-science, anti-medicine. And now we're making all of us vulnerable. And isn't it interesting? They pivot to the undocumented immigrant as the cause and not the Surgeon General.
Yeah, well, look, Joe Latipo and I both went to Harvard School of Public Health. Harvard is not sending Florida their best anymore. He is not the top of the public health food chain, as Ron DeSantis said, although there's some good stuff in his letter. I did actually read it. He does tell people, you know, don't just go walk into a clinic if you have symptoms, because there are other people there who might be infected. But I do think I was struggling to come with a good example, and there may not be one, but I don't want to live in a theocracy, but I think there are more benign theocracies, and then there are sort of theo-idiocracies, and that's what we're headed for. People who can't read their own testament. It's a bizarre set of cult views. You know, the Bible has some strange stuff in it, but the misinterpretations and the interpolations of what isn't in the Bible are even worse. And yeah, I grew up with the moon landing. It's a shame we haven't advanced that crusade, that set of achievements. But I never thought we would be going back to measles and typhus and cholera. Yes. And that's where we're headed.
Yeah, absolutely. And this morning, Adam, on the radio show I did on this commercial station, when we were talking about the loss of birth control and what did it mean, I was telling the audience that my Norwegian grandmother only had one child, my father. And that was because after she gave birth to my father, the doctor said, you can never get pregnant again, you will die. I've told this story before. And of course, this is before birth control. So what did that mean? She got pregnant again. And then what did she have to do? She had to make a decision. She looked at my father and had to make a decision. Was she going to be around and alive to help raise my father? Or was she going to figure out a way to have an illegal abortion? She had an illegal abortion. And that's why with the passage of Roe, she was so happy, because that meant that my future would not be about these kinds of unconscionable choices. But that's what happens. This is real. It's happened before, and we're going back to that, which to me in so many ways is so incredibly shocking, everyone. Let me just turn to you, Stephen, and then we'll actually continue with you after the break. I'm also looking at, like, when I was speaking at Harvard, one of the sort of undertones was that everybody was afraid to publicly have a conversation about what's happening between Israel and Hamas. So it was the rumblings in the room, but almost the conversation that was not articulated, because everyone's walking on broken glass. And I want to sort of have the conversation after the break about the story coming out of Michigan. And that is that Biden faces major challenge on Gaza in next week's Michigan primary. And everyone's saying, isn't this horrible? And in a lot of ways, I think it's the opportunity to finally send a message to Biden. This isn't about the November election, but it is about a primary in a state where there are a lot of Muslims, in a state that is absolutely horrified by what they see. And I think that their messaging there is actually very important and actually incredibly appropriate. Does that make sense to you, Stephen?
It does. I mean, it's from the reporting that I've read. This is not folks saying that they're not going to vote in November, or that they are not going to vote for Biden in November, or certainly that they are going to vote for Trump, but that they are angry and frustrated and scared and trying to find a vehicle to communicate that more effectively to the administration. And this seems like a perfectly sensible, very low stakes way to do it, right? Somebody else is not going to wind up winning this primary as a consequence of this. But if enough people voice their discontent, right, and we're setting aside the question for the moment of how much actual power and influence Biden and the American administration actually has over Israeli policy, that this seems to me a thoughtful and sensible way to try to express to people in power dissatisfaction with their behavior.
They can't do that with Republicans. They can only do it with this Biden nomination. Let's be honest. With Trump, it can't be hurt. Lincoln, yes?
Remember, ceasefire got no support in New Hampshire. But there's a real possibility that what happens here is that the none of the above, which is what they're asking people to do in Michigan, gets a tiny number. I don't think we can assume that it could, but let's not go into this assuming that it gets 20 or 30%. 1,500 people.
I hear you, but guess what? When you look at the numbers that Biden needs in those swing states, that tiny percentage that you're talking about is how many he could lose.
And he could lose every Arab American vote. If every Arab American who's voted for Biden voted for Trump, he would still carry Michigan handily. The numbers here are more complicated than that. It is not that simple. But my point underperforms, it sends a message of support for Biden. And they're organizing, it sends a message of support. And Don't assume that's not going
to
happen.
This is the Rethink the Week. It's the Monday edition of The Attitude. We need to go to a break. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back with our panel.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. To understand Trump's dominance of the Republican Party is that yesterday he beat Nikki Haley in her home state by 20 points. And most people think Haley exceeded expectations. In other words, losing your home state by 20 points is considered a pretty good showing for Nikki Haley. But despite what you may read on some bizarre opinion pieces that I saw this morning at CNN, Haley has no chance of being the nominee. From here, the primaries go to states that are even stronger for Trump. Now, some might say, but this is good. Haley is speaking to a group within the Republican Party that is genuinely sick of Trump. And if she keeps getting 30 or 40%, it will chip away at Trump. There may be some truth to that, although if we look at previous primaries, there's very little evidence for that theory. But remember, there is still a very good chance that sometime between, I don't know, June 1st and August 15th, Haley endorses Trump. She had signed the pledge saying she would support the nominee. She hasn't really burned any bridges that make it impossible for her to do that. And while she wants a future in the Republican Party, she can't have that future if she doesn't endorse Trump. And when she endorses Trump, all the things she said about him will be wiped away. And instead of taking a group of Republicans out of the Trump coalition, she will be giving them a good reason to stay in.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Let's reflect for a minute on the recent remarks of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan.
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Justice Kagan, during a public conversation at the Library of Congress, avoided saying anything directly relevant to any case before the court. But she did articulate decision-making principles and powerfully shared her perspective on the court discarding precedent. Justice Kagan said, "When the law flip-flops after change in personnel on the court, it doesn't look like law anymore. It looks like a form of politics." She continued, "And I think that's especially important for this Supreme Court at this time. Law should not look like a form of politics, where just because the composition of the court changes, a whole batch of legal rules change with it." Justice Kagan added, "When what was once a right is no longer a right because the court is different, I think that's very damaging to the court, very damaging to society." Justice Kagan did not mention any one of the dozens of examples where this Supreme Court has reversed or dramatically changed longstanding law, but as Adam Liptak wrote in the New York Times, it was a good bet that the court's 2022 decision overruling Roe versus Wade was among one of the ones on her mind. And let us add, ours too.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people, this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019,
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Rethink the Week, the Monday edition, which we actually record on Friday morning. We're being rejoined by Stephen Pimpera, senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University, and Adam Finkel, who's a clinical professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. So before we went to the break, Stephen Pimpera, we were talking a little bit about Michigan and none of the above, and does it send a message? Are they organizing? We heard that from Lincoln Mitchell. But I am going to tell you something that I actually said when I was at Harvard. And that is that, you know, we keep talking about that democracy is on the line. And if we lose to Donald Trump in 2024, you know, we will have lost democracy. Can I just say something? This feels like what a precursor to what it's going to be like with no democracy. Because when you look at the campaign for president on both the Republican and Democratic side, who were the least consequential in making this decision? It was voters. We absolutely, Stephen, did not matter. It didn't matter who we were. It didn't matter what state we were. We were given no choice. None. Niente. Both on the Republican side and the Democrat side. I mean, there may have been the illusion of something going on in the primary with the Republicans, but you and I both know it didn't exist, and it never really has. And on the Democratic side, once again, even though Joe Biden sort of kind of promised that he would be the bridge, and everyone had this understanding that he would be a one-term president, and then once again, he said, only I can defeat Donald Trump. Then we began to understand that we had no choice again, and he was running for reelect. And I keep telling people, you want to know what it's like? Well, the sense of frustration and none of the above, and we don't want either, is because we didn't matter, Stephen. We didn't matter for this important presidential campaign at a time where everything is on the line. Climate is on the line. Women's bodily autonomy is on the line. Democracy is on the line. And yet what? We were not engaged, and we didn't matter in what our choices were going to be. And I think that's part of the anger, frustration, and resentment on the part of a lot of people, is that they've already told me that, you know what? The franchise isn't that important because I didn't need to go to you. I didn't need to talk to you. And then the result was I'm going to deliver whatever I want to deliver, and then you have to make that choice.
So I'm not sure how much of that I actually agree with, Arnie. I think that since 1968 and the last real contested convention, we have moved toward a more and more sort of primary system that generates the illusion that it is competitive primaries and voters that are selecting the candidate. It is still in a famous book among political scientists, the party that decides. Right. These tend to be not exclusively, but often top down decisions. And as evidence of this, I simply say right there, there was a piece by Ezra Klein in the New York Times over the course of the last week in which he is saying, you know what, we should have a contested convention. And I think it is West Wing fan fiction and, to use the technical political science, dumb. That said, right, that frustration could have been dealt with 2 or 3 years ago, right? People talk about, well, what about Gretchen Whitmer? Why doesn't insert name here run? Well, folks could have, right? Folks could have run 2 years ago. There was nothing stopping people other than Dean Phillips from throwing their hats in the room and making this a contested primary. Historically, successful one-term presidents are... It is unusual for a president not to run for re-election and not to get their party's nomination. People are trying to litigate things that are history, and it's all fan fiction, and this is the reality. So make the argument, mobilize the vote.
Okay, so I understand about the fact that the DNC is the master puppeteer, and it's all decided by the party.
No, DNC.
There's no DNC.
So who's making the decision?
Joe Biden.
So you're telling me that the primaries have no meaning. You're telling me that the caucus
have no meaning because there's no serious opponent. And no strong opponent gets in because everybody who's smart enough to be president knows that Biden will win the primaries.
No, I'm not talking now, but because, Stephen, you were talking about the past and that we have this illusion that somehow we're really being given a choice and the choice is predetermined. So tell me something. Explain Obama and Hillary. Who determined that one?
We have competitive primaries. When there's an open seat, it's a flawed process. But it is a competitive one. It's not fixed in advance. That is, I think there's a belief that the DNC...
That's not what Pimpere said.
This is what I'm saying.
I'm agreeing with Lincoln. I just articulated my position poorly.
There's like 12 wise Democrats in a room. There isn't. There's not 12 wise Republicans in the country anymore, let alone in a room making decisions. But the other point is that the reason Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee is essentially what Stephen was saying. It's very, very difficult to defeat an incumbent president in a primary. Even in 68, Johnson got out of a race that he probably would have won. And the evidence of that, we don't know what would have happened because of RFK Sr.'s assassination, but his vice president was the nominee anyway. It's very, very difficult to do that. Donald Trump is the Republican nominee because he is wildly popular within the Republican Party. Whereas the process is kind of absurd, there is overwhelming data that they love this guy. We on the show and most of our listeners presumably do not, but he is the party's nominee. And to go back to something, because he's so popular in the party, to go back to something Stephen talks about even more than I do, this is a flaw of the duopoly. The problem here is not how the Democratic and Republican Party choose their nominees. The problem is we are stuck in this duopoly, which is a product of our Constitution, which almost guarantees you're going to evolve towards a two-party system. It is a product of first-past-the-post states. It is a product of the way the Electoral College has come to be interpreted. If you want more choices, and Andrew Yang, like an annoying, pseudo-Trump clock, is right twice a day, and one of the things he's right about is that we have to change the electoral system. If we had a proportional representation, if we had a parliamentary system, we would not have this problem.
I want to just sort of end this conversation or like move on with you, mercifully, Lincoln, and then I'm going to toss to Adam. And I'm looking at this cacophony of stuff that's happening, and you're absolutely right. For whatever reason, I mean, the Republicans don't even need to show up for a MAGA event. They don't even need, it's almost like they have no other choice in their brain. So I'm not even sure that they're enchanted with him. It's just him. You know, they can't even articulate why. They're just there, you know? And even they keep saying, oh, but I've been to events. He used to have 10,000. Now he only has 8,000. Or I go to events and he's not even showing up. And so it doesn't matter anymore. They don't even need him there to be supportive of him because it's almost like it's not about choosing a president. It's now almost an extension of their arm. They have no idea what to go on. But then I look at what the Republicans are doing, because then there are Republicans who are also now manipulating us. And I want to go to the Biden impeachment. Lincoln, that a GOP Biden informant turns out to be what? Has a link to Russia. In a way, it says there isn't even the first time we've learned that a person who's been indicted after the GOP cited his claims, nor is this the first time a person has been linked to Russian intelligence after the GOP leaned on the version of events. They were even told not to use this information because it really couldn't be proved, but they don't need proof. They just need to hold up something that has the illusion of credibility, and they go with it. And this is why they're, you know, attempting to indict Biden. And even when it's proven that this was a Russian planted information, it doesn't matter. And that's what's so scary, is facts don't matter. Truth doesn't matter. Being around Trump doesn't matter. And yet you've got millions of people that are willing to sort of move in that direction. How do you undo that? How do you disconnect that, Lincoln? I don't see hope going into the future.
Well, I don't think you bring me on your so graciously with such frequency because I give you a sense of hope. But I'll try, maybe. First of all, one important point. The Democratic Party has media outlets that are lean towards them, imperfectly lean towards them. MSNBC, some would say the New York Times, CNN. The Republican Party has propaganda outlets. And the people who consume those propaganda outlets, they go to OAN or Fox or the Washington Examiner or something because they want to. They want that propaganda. They want the party line. So you can tell them kind of anything. Because if you tune on OAN, what you're saying is, tell me the most bizarre, outrageous anti-Biden lie. I just want to hear it. It's just salacious gossip that unfortunately informs their politics. But the second point is that one thing we can do is to be more honest about things. I am really struck, and I don't mean to keep going back with the I told you so's, but in 2017 and 2018, before I was ever on the show, it was glaringly obvious that Putin played at very best a disturbing and nefarious role in the Trump administration and had in the Trump campaign. If you know anything about presidential elections, anything, you understand that without Putin's support, Trump would have lost that election. And to have said that in 2017, very quickly, a segment of the mainstream media that was such a disturbing thought that they simply shut it down. Then what happened is on the far left, because so many of them, you know, they are okay with Putin. They watch a little too much of RT, Russia Today, as it was then called. They then began to accuse, you know, liberal Democrats and kind of more moderate Democrats of being too focused on Russia. Trump just repeated the word Russia hoax like it was some kind of a mantra for, you know, 4 years, and we stopped talking about it. But here we are in late February of 2024, and it is more clear than ever that the Republican Party is a Putinist party, and their chief propagandist of the Republican Party just went to Russia to almost literally kiss Putin's ring. And to repeat kind of pro-Russia talking points about the subways and how cheap the groceries are that would have made Communist Party members in the 1940s embarrassed for being too sycophantic to Moscow.
So let me just toss to Adam. Adam, I thought the funniest thing was when he was so shocked when he went to the grocery store and saw that people could put money in and get their grocery card, and then they would return their grocery card and get their money back. And he was like, look at the brilliance of Russia. And I'm thinking, oh my God, have you been to Aldi? I'm just like, have you been to, it's like, the level of sheer stupidity or ignorance or being manipulated is just unbelievable to me. But I also want to talk about what Democrats can do. And I think we're beginning to see this, and we've been screaming this forever, because you know that anything that the Republicans did, they want to own it. They put their name on it. They address it. They say, I delivered it. They cut the ribbon. Well, what is Biden doing? Biden owns it. I wrote this. He will email 153,000 student borrowers with the following note. I am canceling your debt. I hope this relief gives you a little more breathing room. I mean, people like me have been screaming for the longest time. Don't just do it, own it, say it, repeat it. And it appears that finally Biden is connecting the dots, because people don't connect the dots between the policy that's giving them that debt relief and the individual or the politicians that actually turned around and made that result. And I think that this is a slow start, but finalmente, Adam.
Yeah, look, I just want to say one thing about the primary system. I'm pleased. I'm not excited enough as I'd like to be by Joe Biden, but I'm pleased with the choice. We have a choice to say who we are in November, one or the other of these two candidates. I'm glad that, you know, God forbid it isn't Trump against, you know, Joe Manchin or Kirsten Sinema or somebody like that. So thank you. You know, however that happened, I'm happy with that. Tucker Carlson. Oh, my God. You say go to Aldi's, you know, go to the New Hampshire legislature and hear them screaming about how a bottle bill will cause, you know, the collapse of the solar system. So, yeah, they don't understand a lot. Look, I used to think, and I'm coming to around to the view, why is every accusation a confession among, you know, the base, among tens of millions of people? And I used to think, and maybe I read this somewhere, that it was internalized shame and people just deflected their deep feelings of self-loathing because of all the bad stuff they do by just screaming about other people doing worse stuff. I'm coming around to believe that it's part of this horrible bully / snowflake persona, where the best way to become a victim is to commit crimes or you know, horrible interpersonal things, and then just scream as loud as you can that it's somebody else doing it, because then when they correctly point out in the media or in a court of law or in the legislature that you or your group have done bad things or committed crimes, then you become the victim of bullying. I mean, it's just the worst vicious cycle. And, you know, I don't know how much of the Steele dossier has been disproven. I don't know how much of it would just happen to be untrue. I don't know how much of it is true. It's you know, not de rigueur to talk about it anymore, as Lincoln said. But was that document, you know, more true than the Biden impeachment documents, whatever such they are? I assume so. And yet, you know, it becomes it's laughable to talk about what happened in 2016. And I definitely agree with Lincoln that it was a close election and Putin has something to do with it. And I just wish my grandparents were around. The last of them died in 1979, but they all came from Ukraine, but was Russia at the time, and fled Tsarism. And I would just wonder what they would think about their, you know, genetic forebears living under another czar. It's you know, what's happening here is crazy, but what's happening there is really crazy.
So, Stephen Pimper, we have Bill Curry on every week. And one of the things that Bill Curry talks about is that people are so used to politicians talking, what they're not used to is delivering. And so part of the reason why we don't connect the delivery to the politician is that, one, we've been let down so often, but two, we don't always own what it is that we do. And that's why I mentioned the thing about the student loans, where he sends a personal note saying, I hope this will give you some relief. And he's clearly owning it. And one of the things I mentioned to these students last week was that think about Florida. To me, I love using Florida as my template about really the challenges for policy and politicians. And here's the challenge. Remember in 2018, when in Florida, they reinstated the franchise to ex-felons. And they thought they were going to be so clever in the Florida legislature that they were going to make them have to reach 60% before they would ever be able to reinstate the franchise to ex-felons. And then guess what happened? I think they got close to 65%. What a shock. So not only did the people speak, but overwhelmingly, with a number that you and I would both go crazy for, but then they elected a legislature and a governor that made it almost impossible to restore the franchise. And my question is, how do we get people to understand the action and the people? Because there has to be a connect the dots. If you want to raise the minimum wage, if you want to restore the vote, if you want to make sure that women have control over their bodies, all these things can't happen because you pass a referendum. Because a referendum without the right Supreme Court, a referendum without the right governor, a referendum without the right legislature, guess what? It's butt kiss. And we haven't been able to connect the dots, Stephen Pimper.
I mean, easier said than done, right? I mean, I think there are a number of challenges at work there. One is that we know now from decades worth of surveys and political science research that the majority and probably overwhelming majority of the American public are ignorant of politics and policy. Not stupid, but right, they don't know what's going on. They're not paying careful attention. They're doing other things. They're trying, as George W. Bush said, trying to put food on their family, you know, struggling with all kinds of other things. Add on to that the extent to which we have an extraordinarily fractured media environment, right? Whereas, you know, Lincoln pointed out, we've got some people are going to propaganda outlets, others, you know, so they're turning on whatever half an hour of CNN. That's better because they're not intentionally trying to lie to you. But I don't think that's a particularly good source of information. And often you've got people who have shallow knowledge yelling at each other or staging sort of performative debates, but you're not sort of getting that regular source, right? So what is the venue by which, if you want to connect those dots, Arnie, you do that, right? I think that's the challenge, right? The medium through which we communicate that narrative? And I don't have a particularly good answer for that other than identify all of the places you possibly can, hire a better communications operation for the campaign and the White House, and start pushing out those messages as much as you can, as far as you can.
What is old is new again for me. That's where I talk about the messages. Social media, nah. What's going on CNN and cable, nah. You know, everyone's in their own silo. So where do I go? Where is the common place that I go where I know a Republican could be next to me, a conservative can be behind me, a liberal can be to the side of me, and that is I am going to the old-fashioned billboard. And the reason I'm going to the old-fashioned billboard is that you can't avert your eyes. All right. In fact, my understanding is that RFK Jr., when he was being attacked by the DNC, turned around and bought 9 billboards in the state to be able to sort of challenge the DNC. He didn't go to social media, and that got free media. Everyone mentioned that what was in the billboards, and everybody started to look at the billboards to see what RFK Jr. was saying. And I really do think that what we need to begin to figure out is that not only do we have to figure out the message delivery, but you know what Republicans have excelled at brilliantly? And that is a word that we don't even want to embrace. And that word is repetition. What is the repetition for Democrats? What do we stand for? I can tell you what Republicans stand for. No regulation, no taxes, no government. I can roll them up. What did if you ask a person on the street, what did Democrats stand for? You will get a flurry of answers, none of which are consistent and none of which may even be accurate. That's part of the problem too. We haven't really emblazoned the public with who we are and what we stand for and then show the policies that flow from that. I mean, I hate to say it, it's old fashioned. But you know what? Old fashioned works because the Republicans are literally the living proof of that.
Well, the Democratic Party is a coalition. The Republican Party is essentially a cult. And that raises very, very different communications challenges. Yeah. One, what does the Republican Party stand for? If you ask, 20 Republicans on the street, 18 of them are going to say Trump. And if you ask the Democrat, 20 Democrats, you're going to get, 18, 20 different answers probably. And the reason is because it stands for a lot of different things. It stands for LGBT rights.
Yeah.
It stands for attempts at more equitable economic policy. It stands for investing in infrastructure. It stands for Ukraine. It stands for Israel. It stands for Gaza. It stands for, and this has always been the case, to some extent, for much of our modern history, the Republican Party has been the white, straight Christian folk, big majorities of those. And it used to be Protestants, you could even say, and the Democratic Party is everything else. So you're not going to get a simplified message that easily. And it is not a fault of the president that it's difficult to do that. However, at the end of the day, in 2024, there is going to be one very simple message from the Democratic Party. And it's the winning message that keeps winning over and over again. It is not the message that people, like I've said this on your show before, that if you want to get on CNN and talk about how the Democratic Party should be messaging and Bidenomics and all of this, that's fine. But if you want to win this election, the message is this. Donald Trump is the alternative. And scaring people about Trump is, it doesn't sound, we don't want to believe it's true because we want to think that we're more sophisticated and the politics are more sophisticated. It has worked over and over and over again. Joe Biden did not get elected in 2020 because he was a generational political talent or because he had much of a promise. Build Back Better is a complete platitude, which is largely meaningless. But he wasn't Donald Trump. The Democratic Party staunched the bleeding in 2022. Obviously, the Dobbs, in terms of the midterm election where they were expected to get trounced, obviously Dobbs helped, but they weren't Donald Trump. Tom Suozzi just won a few miles away from here because he was making that about Trump. The way you win this election is you reduce this message. It's us or Trump. And that has been a winning message and very well could be a winning message again in November.
Well, I also think the winning message, Adam, though, I think right now with the abortion and the IVF, they've also given us a gift. If it's Trump, you can mention Trump, but you have to connect the dots to remind people exactly how toxic Trump is. He's thrown so much at us, Adam, that in a lot of ways we forget. You know, like he put classified documents in his bathroom. I mean, people are laughing when they hear it, but that was part of the, I mean, there's so much that in a way saying it's not Trump isn't enough. We have to remind everyone, I think, Adam, who exactly Trump is, and not Trump is essential for our future.
Yeah, I agree with Lincoln. It's not just that he is literally standing on Fifth Avenue and shooting people and getting votes. It's that he's got a bunch of clones who are doing the same, and the number is growing. As you said in the poem, they're coming for us. And it would be lovely to have a great, climate change and justice message, but they're coming for us. We have to not succumb to that.
This is the billboards I want, since I mentioned the old technology that I believe in. And the billboard goes like this. Here's one. Biden and Trump are both too old, but only one is a traitor. Biden and Trump are both too old, but only one is a pathological liar. Biden and Trump are both too old, but only one is a fascist in waiting. Biden and Trump are both too old, but only I would go through over and start by saying, so I can neutralize the old, but then remind everyone who Trump is. And you can say Trump, but you've got to say more. Sorry about that, Lincoln. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We've been talking with Adam Finkel, Lincoln Mitchell, and Stephen Pimper. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. Change.